Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchudas.
Eric, my Twitter has been blowing up so far this week because we did this video series with our colleagues at Bloomberg Quick Take that turned Trillions from the podcast that we hold so dear to us into a video show.
Yeah, it's our second production, the first one being that ETF story audio documentary, but that still was audio only. This is our first foray into video, and it was fun. I had a good time. I thought I was proud that we were able to highlight a part of the industry that is rarely highlighted, and for an audience that is more retail and is able to get an inside look at how professionals assemble ETF portfolios and pick ETFs and think about the market.
And you had a kind of a, I will credit you for this epiphany. I've long talked about food on the show, as any listener knows. You were the one that brought it all together. So, and we had some guests who are amazing, and all of those guests are going to join us today. What was your epiphany?
Well, we were debating what to do, and two things. One, a lot of our ideas were just disparate. It would require like so much different, like go to the gold vault, and it was like, man, this is going to take weeks to pull off four-minute episodes. So one of it was just convenience. You know, let's just shoot it all in one day. But the other thing was, you know, again, it comes back to when I wrote my book on ETFs in 2015. I was interviewing institutions, and none of them really knew about ETFs. They knew like the top 10 most traded one, like SPY and IWM. But then I would interview a certain kind of investor called an ETF strategist, and they knew everything. I mean, I could throw the 37th tech ETF at them, and they would have an opinion on it. And so for the whole second half of the book, I quote these strategists. And as I talked to them, I just felt that what they were doing was making ETF recipes, essentially. I almost called the book the ETF Cookbook, and I was going to put some of their recipes. It went a different direction, but that idea, I guess, just sort of lingered in the back of my mind for the years after, and finally it found a home here. So we kind of made it like a MasterChef TV show.
Oh, it's like genius. Okay, joining
Thank
us
you.
On this episode.
I sense a little sarcasm there, but I'll take it.
It was rich with sarcasm. Okay, so joining us on this episode, we got John Davies, Shane Estissel, Tushar Yadava, and Ben Levine. This time on Trillions, the ETF Master Chefs. John, Shana, Tushar, Ben, thanks for joining us on Trillions, the podcast this time.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Yeah, welcome.
Happy to be here.
Okay, Tushar, I want to start with you. Can you describe when we're not using a forced metaphor like being a master chef? How do you describe being an ETF strategist?
I mean, I would say, you know, credit to Eric, right? And I'm going to just blow smoke right in his direction and say that this is the king of all metaphors. But you know, look, I think. What we're trying to do is we're trying to build portfolios for, at least on our side, and portfolios that we're building for advisors that they can use to help scale their practice, help build wealth for their households. And so, you know, really, if there wasn't some killer metaphor, I mean, maybe it would be, you know, kind of like thinking about building blocks, but that's so hackneyed and so well-traveled, I think, in the ETF world that I think, you know, no one can see the screens now, but everyone's shaking their heads at me with disdain. So, you know, I'd say maybe that's probably the closest experience you could think of. But really, you know, it is about that sort of end product of just what you put out there, what the model looks like, what it's behaving like in markets like we've seen over this year, and what it's doing for households and their end results, you know, which we're hoping to build that wealth for them and do it net of fees with less risk, which is kind of the big goal that we're looking for.
And let me jump in here real quick, because one thing that I discovered when I was covering ETFs, it was like years into covering them, that was that advisors don't really do a lot of investing. That was something I, you know, some do, but a lot of them outsource it. They're going to work on planning the like estate planning and the relationships and the behavioral coaching. I guess I'll go to John for that one. Can you talk a little bit about what advisors are doing in that they're going to use your portfolio? What are they doing then, since you're doing the investing?
It's exactly what you said. It's, you know, they're worrying about the overall client relationship. So they're doing taxes, insurance, estate planning, behavioral coaching, You know, and they, their expertise isn't really to be markets people or to know how to design a portfolio. So that's where they leave that to, you know, sub-advisors such as, you know, Ben, myself, Tushar, Shanna. So I think it's a win-win for everyone. The end client gets a better portfolio experience, a better outcome that they're looking to solve for. And, you know, everyone is happy in the end.
Do they ever come back or do they ever look at it and go, hey, man, why'd you pick, you know, XLK instead of VGT or whatever? Like, do they ever needle you over your picks?
Well, I mean, what happens nowadays is, you know, the S&P has gone straight up the last 10 years. So everyone wants to just know why you didn't do as good as the S&P. But that's a separate conversation. I mean, you know, Shannon, myself, Ben, I mean, we could spend hours talking about that alone. But they don't really go too much into the weeds. They just like to look at, like, how the account is growing. And, you know, sometimes the financial advisor will actually say, why did you pick this one ETF? This is down, whereas the market's up. And then you got to explain, okay, you know, when you build a portfolio, it's like a recipe, you know, all the ingredients fit together. Some are supposed to add spice, some are supposed to be, you know, sweet, savory. But as a collection, the entire recipe works out in the end. So sometimes you have to explain, like, okay, this one ETF is meant to, like, be your portfolio dampener. We're supposed to, you know, provide protection.
Shana, you had kind of the rock star portfolio. So I'm going to ask you, if there's one other portfolio that you most envied other than your own, which one was it?
I like John Davies portfolios. As a matter of fact, it's one of those portfolios that complements well some of the stuff we do, which is a little more exotic, a little more, as you put, rock star-ish. Those inflation-oriented types of portfolios actually are a great hedge that we can layer on top. And we do look at Astoria's products at Spotlight to complement some of the things we're doing because, you know, we're a small organization. We can't do everything in-house. So we look to people just like everybody that's here, whether it be John or Ben or Tushar. We are looking to use their expertise as along with our own in-house to layer upon and complement depending on our clients' needs.
And just talk a little bit about, you had some clients that were athletes, and everybody's always intrigued about that because we actually hear about athletes getting ripped off by their advisors pretty frequently, or movie stars getting into bad deals. Everybody remembers Madoff. What's a conversation with an athlete like when you're sharing your portfolio or with the relationship manager who shares the portfolio? Do they kind of care what the tickers are, or they just sort of trust you? How's it work?
That's interesting because I think we understand the risks that a lot of athletes have in terms of they have capital, they have assets, and so they are often asked to invest in, you know, relatively risky things as an angel or in a venture capacity. So we're aware of those concerns that they have, and we actually try to present ourselves and as a gatekeeper for them. You know, we look at these core portfolios as a way of, you know, having that trust and saying, look, we're not going to sell you anything exotic. Here's a nice core model for you to begin with the foundation of your assets. And then as things get presented to you, we're your gatekeeper. We're going to do the due diligence for you. We're going to help you make these decisions. We're going to be honest with you and tell you this sounds like a scheme. Because quite frankly, as a fiduciary, and with the expertise that we have, me in particular, working in the private fund market, I can look at some fine print on a pitch deck and tell you right away, like, this is not going to fly for me. Asking the right questions, finding out who other backers are. You know, our goal is to present ourselves and to sort of be that trusted gatekeeper for our athlete clients. And I think that's why they trust us. We're not selling them anything overly exotic. If there's something in particular that they're interested in looking into, we can do that. But more often than not, they get in trouble because they get presented with opportunities and no one's doing the real due diligence for them. They're kind of doing it on their own. And that's where they end up with problems. And not all financial advisors have the capacity to do that. And we're just lucky in that someone like myself, who's been doing private fund due diligence for the last 15 years, does have some expertise in that area and can look at some of the things that they get presented with and say, look, this isn't good for your brand. maybe it's a fine investment, but maybe it's not aligned with their brand, or, you know, I just don't think this is an appropriate way to you know, invest your money right now. And let me tell you all the red flags I found along the way in the due diligence process.
Ben, you've been quiet so far. You had one of the most, I think, impressive video performances out of all of us. Eric and I both looked fat and schlubby on camera, and you were like, you know, keto fit.
By the way, can I just address this? Anybody who's watched this video, I've lost 10 pounds since we shot that. But yeah, Ben showed us all up. But Ben, I thought Ben also, Ben dove into the metaphor the hardest.
He went all the way.
He went all the way.
Ben, what kind of movie deals have you struck since your Trillions debut?
I'm still low profile. Our podcast numbers in the hundreds, not the thousands.
Okay. So Ben, what did you learn from the other guests that we had on and just the whole experience of doing the video series with us?
Just that there is more than one type of chef, to extend the metaphor. You can look at an ETF portfolio either as a recipe that has combined ingredients, or you can look at it as a bento box that has kind of its own individual dishes pulled together into sort of one cohesive lunchtime meal. I would say that there isn't just a one size fits all approach to asset allocation. What we have discovered over the years with ETFs is it really is a technological advancement from traditional asset allocation that has been historically done with either mutual funds or with separate accounts. And ETFs just extends that asset allocation exercise in a much more efficient, practical, tax-effective manner. And so the chefs can basically apply their style, their chef-making skills, and create portfolios in a much more seamless fashion using ETFs. Whereas with mutual funds that didn't have intraday pricing, that didn't have the same kind of transparency that we have with ETFs, you can still cook a meal with them, but it's different in the sense that you really just sort of don't have as, I would say, transparent access to what it is that you're putting together like you do with the ETF structure.
And like when you're all you guys, when I worked with you to pick the portfolio, we had this prep call, like which one should we choose? And we tried to be diverse. Some were a little more aggressive and some were more, I think, Tushar, you had the most vanilla 60-40. But do you guys just walk down the street and then one day you're like, you know what, that's the next portfolio? Or like where do you get the idea to add to your menu, so to speak? I guess I'll start with Ben and then go to Tushar.
Sure. I mean, some of the newer portfolios we've launched have come from our advisors. And typically that's where you see the best product development occur or the best solution development occurs, is you get requests from advisors. Hey, can you do this? So we did that with the global growth model that we profiled on your show. We've done that with ESG. We did that more recently with a downside protection strategy that doesn't look to do tactical asset allocation, but instead invest in the newly launched buffer ETFs that are invested in collar option programs. So these are all ideas that came from our advisor base. And I think that's where you basically get your best ideas in terms of what you could be doing differently.
And Tushar, you know, BlackRock is massive. And I'm, you know, obviously the biggest asset manager, biggest model portfolio maker. And when you make a shift, I mean, I can see it in the flows. I mean, I have my NAV screen and it's just, boom. It's like, okay, they must have done something. It's either you or Merrill. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure on you. How many people do you have to get approval from before you move out of, say, USMV into MTUM or something?
Yeah, I mean, from the portfolio management team, there is some very heavy debate that goes on. There's a lot of committee you know, meeting that goes on, and you know, it's something that is extremely, you know, we can do it in a heartbeat if we have to respond to a market environment, but it's also something that isn't done lightly, right? And there's a lot of work that goes into preparing any kind of trade. You want to think about it and make sure you're sort of ex ante kind of changes in risk, what you're looking for in your information ratio, all these kind of wonkish ways of thinking about how you're adjusting your portfolio to make sure the move that you're making is additive. It is really important. And then there's just the basic portfolio hygiene of rebalancing every quarter, I think, that we do that's pretty important as well. And, you know, a lot of what we do comes back to, you said vanilla, like, you know, pejoratively, but I'll remind you that vanilla is the most popular flavor in the United States. And everyone's had bad vanilla and, you know, everyone's had Tahitian vanilla in the little gelato, like, you know, glass jar thing that you pay $8 for and, you know, you're trying to impress family with. And I try and believe that we're truly in that, you know, and I said it, I think, on the show, is like, it's a very simple product, but if you can deliver it in a really powerful manner, that resonates. And I think when you look inside our model, you've got things like ESG in there as a stock selection bet. You've got commodities in there as inflation protection. You know, we're looking at fallen angels. We're looking at sectors. So it's not your basic 60-40, you know, just sort of set it and forget it. And we're trading on things like, you know, the worst of COVID or, you know, the aftermath of the election last year. So we consider ourselves and pride ourselves on being active managers. And I think the portfolio reflects that, even if it is a bit vanilla. And I didn't come up with the fantastic analogy of the bento box. Ben had to have written that down.
I know.
Days in advance.
Isn't it amazing how easy the food metaphor is, though? Like, once it's just like right there. It's like so easy. How can you not?
It's the smoothest swing, and he just pulled it out and just laid it out there.
Right? I am so not a food person. I just want to jump on some things that Tushar just said. You know, I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure people really understand some of the thought process that has to go in, especially if you're larger or a larger percentage of a fund. Having worked for Fidelity Strategic Advisors, you know, there's exemptive relief issues. There's just a courtesy that occurs where if you're a large investor in a fund and perhaps you have exemptive relief, you give a lot of notice or you try to give a lot of notice to the funds you're invested in. Because you understand that if you move into or out of a fund, you are going to affect the price of that product. It's not as big a deal as in ETFs, because ETFs have the ability to, through the creation redemption process, get rid of the arbitrage related to those individual inflows, outflows. In the mutual fund world, it's a lot harder because if you know you are a large investor, and you're going to move your money, you have to understand the second you do that, unless you do it in a really organized way over days or months, you are going to move the price of that either upwards or downwards, depending on how your money's going in. And there's a lot of thought goes into that, even at a small firm like Spotlight. You know, I'm a big user of alternative funds, whether they be mutual funds, ETFs, or, you know, we talked about crypto a little bit on my little segment. These are products that don't have a ton of liquidity and don't have a lot of market cap. So even a small firm like Spotlight, you know, last year we had a fairly substantial position in an ETF called BTAL. And even at, you know, a small firm like us, we actually did have impact on that fund's pricing. We had to work with a market maker at our custodian to help us move out of that so that we were not negatively impacting the price of that product. And you do have to think about those things.
It's huge for even the smallest or even the largest of sort of providers. It's something that I don't think a lot of people, you know, appreciate that, you know, all of us, right, John and Ben and yourself, are trying to make sure that we're having a positive experience in the market as well. And you know, people in the model that are still in the model, that are, you know, staying in the model with how you're trading, you don't want that kind of, you know, negative experience that's connected to your sort of day-to-day operations. And so that's really, really important. People think you're just putting portfolios together, but we spend a ton of time thinking about the market impact of what we have on these ETFs. And you mentioned with the ETF, it's beautiful with the creation redemption structure that you can get around a lot of that. But Eric mentioned earlier as well, he can look at his nav screen and he could point to our prints, right, as soon as they hit the tape. And so there's a lot of eyes that are on that as well, right? And with a mutual fund, maybe you just have some cash drag and, you know, it doesn't ever get seen. But with the ETF world, it's very visible and you have to make sure that you're, you know, doing no harm, so to speak.
You mean your fingerprints are on the cookie jar?
Exactly.
I call it footprints. And that's why I call Merrill Bigfoot. you there's a sighting every once in a while, and you just know it when it's a big footprint. But it's Tushar, I will say a kudos to your PR department for acknowledging now when it is you. Like, notice lately when news calls you and says, was this big flow out of such and such, you're like, yeah, it was us. We appreciate that. But anyway, one thing I would like to talk about, and Shayna brought it up, and I'll go to Ben on this, because you have a lot of products that some of them I've never even heard of. I mean, or I guess I saw once but forgot about. This is very different than a normal bigger professional institutional investor who tends to stay to the top 50 products. Could you just talk about how deep you go in the toolbox, and do you analyze every new ETF that comes out on the market? I mean, how much of your job is just keeping your eye on the smaller, less known stuff?
So this will be a shameless plug for Bloomberg, but I couldn't do my job without having my Bloomberg terminal and Morningstar analytics available. Bloomberg Port is the analytical tool we use that can basically dig behind the holdings of the ETFs, whether they're equity or fixed income. We're going to look at what the systematic risks are associated with the underlying portfolio. And that basically gives us a pretty good idea of not only what the portfolio looks like from a risk standpoint, but then when you combine that portfolio with other portfolios, which is very, again, very handy tool to have something like Port and Morningstar around, then you can see how those portfolios get combined together. That means we don't shy away necessarily from the smaller ETF providers. Now, I will say, Port is limited in terms of what it can analyze. And because of the ETF rule, we're now seeing a launch of some very interesting ETFs built on investment concepts and built on underlying products, securities, or derivatives that you can't necessarily easily track with something like Port or Morningstar. For instance, there was an ETF that just got rolled out that is betting on long negative convexity. In essence, it's a major bear market fixed income product that basically will do really well in the event that we have a major bear market type of sell-off in the bond market. That's not really something you can track easily in Port. But that said, I mean, if you kind of have the reason why ETFs are so attractive is because the rules are laid out there. They're laid out in the prospectus. They're laid out in the firm's documentation. This is what the product is designed to do. You can confirm that with analytical tools for the most part. And so whether it's a huge multi-billion-dollar fund or if it's a fund that just got launched out of the gate with seed capital, we'll take a look at it.
You know, the reality, Ben, and Joel and Eric, is that, you know, these super sophisticated products, you know, it's basically the person listening to this podcast is really not going to understand what those products are, you know, how they can be utilized. That's why I think they need, you know, strategists or, you know, guys like Eric and his team to kind of analyze these ETFs, because what I fear is, like, you know, and I've been involved with ETFs since the late 90s. I remember when iShares, you know, launched 50 ETFs on the first day when they went to market. You know, we're getting so down the risk curve in terms of how complicated these products are, leveraged, super sophisticated. This is why I think you need education and you need people to explain, like, okay, a negative convexity fixed income ETF. I mean, people in the institutional world that don't understand that, let alone people, you know, that are listening to this podcast. So I think we just have to be careful as fiduciaries, you know, just to make sure that people understand what they're using.
With some of those more complex products having written prospectus and mandates, oftentimes we leave them pretty open-ended on purpose. We want to have flexibility. We also understand that things are going to happen. For example, you know, oftentimes at the very end of the month, just by virtue of when the snapshot was taken, it could look like you had negative cash because somebody had a redemption and you don't actually have negative cash. It's just a cash flow in process, but just that's when the snapshot was taken. So when we're writing that legal ease in those documents, we want to be clear in what the intended stated purpose of the product is, whether it be an ETF, mutual fund, closed-end fund, name your product. But that the language in many of those are written in such a way as to, you know, leave some flexibility and leave some cover, if you will, when weird things happen in the market. And so it's important oftentimes with those more exotic products to make sure you read them. You know, you look at some of these inverse products and people think it's just, hey, I'm shorting the S&P 500. Well, no, you're not. It's mostly derivatives. There's a lot of leverage that's going on there. The way you're getting that exposure is not they're taking the S, the spider and SPY and just shorting it. That's almost never what they're doing. And so understanding that and having a professional, as John said, kind of understand that and be able to tell you, like, this is probably not a product that's best for your risk profile or what you're looking to achieve because there's some inherent risk there that you might not understand is really important.
John, we opened with you. I'm going to bring it back to you here at the end. Your segment on ETF Master Chefs was about your inflation portfolio, and it felt like it was so of the moment when we recorded it. And this was like months ago now that we were all in Brooklyn together and recorded. And I'm just wondering how you feel about that portfolio now and how it stood up, and if you wish you had made any changes or if you had made changes to it since.
Well, I don't think the inflation is like transitory. I don't think you can just kind of turn the inflation spigots on and off. So I still believe in it. You know, there's been trillions of dollars being put into investors' hands. You've got the supply chain shortage, you know, so the cost of materials are going up. It'll be interesting to see if it gets to the point where it's negative for stocks and earnings. And there's a little bit of evidence of that. But, you know, if you look year to date, the best performers are any inflation sensitive assets. Could be commodities, it could be cyclicals. I think, you know, my vantage point, Joel, is like, A, I believe that there is inflation, but even if you don't, the traditional 60-40 portfolio that everyone on this call has is very heavy on tech and very heavy on duration. So there's a lot of fixed income in there. People going out, you know, the duration curve to try and extract yield. So anytime you see an pickup in interest rates, you know, that 60-40 portfolio is going to be negatively impacted. So we've always said just hedge that risk by having 10% in an inflation-sensitive ETF basket. So, you know, what I find people doing is putting, you know, 10 kind of different tickers. That's what we've done. We've optimized it against the S&P. I still think it's relevant. I think we'll be talking about, I mean, Joe, we've been talking about inflation for like 5 years. I think we're going to be talking about the next 5 years. So I still definitely believe in the thesis.
So guys, you know, we brought crypto up to most of you in the actual interview. You know, we said, is this, especially with you, John, because it's sometimes sold as an inflation hedge. Here we are, it's a Wednesday, and the SEC has about 3 or 4 more days to basically stop a whole line of Bitcoin futures ETFs from launching. We think they'll probably let them launch. I think Gensler has signaled this is okay. They're under the 40 Act, yada, yada. So let's assume they are launched. Come next week, come next month, you've got 3 or 4 in the market. Would you guys start using a Bitcoin futures ETF in your portfolio? I'll start with John, just yes or no?
Yes.
Shayna?
No.
Ben?
No.
Tushar?
I would say no for now, but it could always change.
What if iShares was one of those?
It still wouldn't make a difference if we were one of those or not.
It's just kidding.
What we're trying to accomplish with the 60-40 portfolio that, you know.
Well, you do have COMT in there, right? That's a commodity.
Exactly, right?
A lot of you say you cover that with that. You don't actually need it. It's okay.
You just got to think about what it would function in a portfolio, right? And I think all of us, you know, when we're talking about what we do in a portfolio, like what is the function? You're obviously not just sort of, you know, buying it in some NFTs and some memes and just, you know, like laughing, whatever it is, right? Like that's not realistic, right? Like the realistic, like, and it's very pointed. You want to ask a yes or no question, but like clearly, like every one of us would have to analyze, like, you know, what it would do to a portfolio before you think about it. But
crypto is an entirely different mindset of investing. It's DeFi, it's NFTs. You are basically transacting in what Raoul Paul has said, the metaverse. And basically, you think of everything from assets to what is value within a digital concept. And I had a hard time kind of grasping this until I saw some videos of all things about gaming. And basically, gamers talking about all the digital assets that they've accumulated, whether it's a sports type of game or whether it's a battlefield type of game. They clearly view what they hold as having value, even if it's not tangible. So I think it's not just investing in Bitcoin or Ethereum. It's a whole different mindset to the space.
You know what, Eric, I swear 20 years ago, the same things were said about ETFs. I was there. Why do you need a country ETF? Why do you need to short an ETF? It makes no sense. I could just buy, you know, the T. Rowe Price actively managed large cap growth fund. So the same things were said about ETF 20 years ago. I was there.
JD, you were the one asking us that at iShares when we were coming to you for seed money.
I just want to chime in here since I'm one of the folks here that actually does invest in crypto. I said no because I just don't believe I'd rather invest directly. And we are able to do that through our relationship with OnRamp Invest. Eric and I were on a panel just last week at the training show Chicago, where we talked about this at length. My biggest problem with crypto ETFs is lack of market cap. And a futures ETF, I think, has additional issues that impact that. But I'm not anti-crypto. And I think there's a large misunderstanding on you know, whether it's Bitcoin or Ethereum or Ripple or Litecoin, you know, pick your fairly well-known crypto. You know, these are not currencies. They're protocols to send money over the internet. And they all have different pros and cons to their blockchain. So crypto, I think, has room in a portfolio, especially in the types of portfolios we run. I just don't believe an ETF is the way I want to get exposure. My clients, if I'm going to invest in them, I'm going to invest in it directly.
Round robin, last question. It's a question we ask everyone who comes on the podcast. And now that you've done the video version and now the audio version, we got to ask. Shana, I'll start with you. Favorite ETF ticker, and then the quiet one that is just for Tushar, is other than your own.
Just my favorite ticker, like just in general. It's not that I have to invest in it. I like the WTH, the work from home. Okay. Or WFH, sorry.
John.
Yeah, I still like Moo. I've said it on, you know, I've said on the show, and I think on a different podcast I did with Eric, but it's the perfect ticker.
Hall of Fame. Ben,
first ballot,
how about you?
Hall of Fame.
I mean, I like bots. Because
one. We don't hear that often.
Yeah. It's probably pretty evident what it's designed to focus on. So it's robotics.
All right, Tushar, favorite ETF ticker that is not iShares.
Not iShares, so I can't say the iShares one.
Of course.
You know, well, if it was iShares, I would say it would be Veggie in homage to my old boss and John and my friends, Matt. But I would say if it's non, there is a Fidelity consumer discretionary ETF, I believe, that has a particularly hilarious ticker, I think, in my opinion.
That's, you know what? Okay, first of all, I'll say it because he won't. It's FDIS, FDIS. And I agree. There are a couple accidentally amazing tickers. Like, there's no way Fidelity really meant that, but that's why it adds to the whole value add, I think.
I'm going to actually, as my honorable mention, I'm going to just throw out, because not only is it a great ticker, but it's also a great investment. It has been recently. My good friend Perth Toll's FRDM, Freedom, that is a fantastic ticker as well. Yeah, and very descriptive of what it's invested in and has done really well lately because China has done poorly.
Yeah, we've had Perth on. That was an epic ticker as well.
Yeah.
All right, John, Shana, Tushar, Ben, thank you all so much for being ETF master chefs on Trillions, both video and now audio. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great seeing everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas. And you can find all these new episodes with our ETF master chefs at QuickTake. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts. Bye.